morning. My name is Michael McCusker. I would like to start this morning's program with something I wrote. I call it Sons of Liberty. 243 years ago, on July 2nd, 1776, a small group of terrorists betrayed their country and vowed to commit any and all acts of violence and treason which they claimed would be necessary to separate from their government. 2 days later, on July 4th, they publicly declared their intention of betrayal and categorically stated their reasons for turning against their country, and they threatened to murder or otherwise terrorize all who did not join with them. They first began their terrorist acts several years before. They burned, looted, tortured, murdered, kidnapped, and held hostage representatives and supporters of their government. They ambushed and killed soldiers and policemen. Numerous attempts at negotiation only increased their demands and brutality until finally, the previous year, in April 1775, they committed open rebellion by attacking government forces sent to protect loyal citizens from their terrorism. The terrorists cloaked their atrocities and treachery with a specious document that claimed the support of God and the sympathy of humanity. They named their perfidious sedition a Declaration of Independence. And now I'd like to continue with something else I've written, 4th of July Fire Sale. Donald Trump is committing unconstitutional theft of the 4th of July, Independence Day, for his own personal glorification, staging a Stalinesque spectacle in a shameless example of his despotic narcissism. By commandeering the Lincoln Memorial today, he is not only besmirching Abraham Lincoln's legacy, he is also proclaiming on the very day our ancestors publicly rebelled against a king that he is the USA's new self-anointed monarch and that everything Lincoln stood for is dead. Trump is assassinating Lincoln all over again in his evil intent of murdering democracy for his own pervasively delusional avarice of personal grandeur. The American people's constitutional democracy is under assault by its own topmost elected official, who emulates his patron, Putin, that bananas republic fascism must replace what both falsely claim to be the failure of antiquated liberal populist democracy, which Lincoln famously defined for the ages as government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Trump and his White House cabal of opportunist stooges, criminal hypocrites, myopic, loopy dupes, and associated political co-conspirators are fiercely engaged in an Orwellian deconstruction of populist democracy. He has the acerbic deceit, the entire history of the USA, about which he knows nearly zero, devolves upon him. He is forcing the nation into a bitter third civil war. The first was to separate from mother country England and establish a democratic republic. The second was to bloodily define democracy by resisting secession and abolish slavery. And the third is to preserve it from the nihilistic misanthropy that has descended upon it. From his first day, Trump has proved to be the worst and decidedly most autocratic president in America's short history, which he remains resolutely ignorant of. He is also the most unpleasant president, an avatar of violence and hatred, the dark angst negative bane of fragile and inherently flawed constitutional self-rule. And Trump is blind to human rights, contemptuous as of any but his own fetid narcissism. Lincoln said, perhaps critically anticipating a future darksome occupant of the White House claiming imperial aspiration, that such a personal imposture is, quote, as thin as the homeopathic soup that was made by boiling the shadow of a pigeon that has been starved to death. As the marvelous Paul Robeson sang about Lincoln 80 years ago in the original 1939 recording of Ballad for Americans by Earl Robinson and John Latouche, "Old Abe Lincoln was thin and long. His heart was high and his faith was strong. But he hated oppression, he hated wrong, and he went down to his grave to free the slaves. As I would not be a slave, so would I not be a master," Lincoln said. "This expresses my idea of democracy. Whatever differs from this to the extent of the difference is no democracy. Why should there not be a patient confidence in the ultimate justice of the people? Is there any better or equal hope in the world?" Lincoln said. And he said that while the people retain virtue and vigilance, no administration by any extreme of wickedness or folly can very seriously injure the government in the short space of 4 years. "Malice toward none, with charity for all," are not words Trump would feel much sympathy for, which Lincoln emphasized at his second inauguration, which few Americans wish for Trump to have. Nor would Trump be in accord with Lincoln's maxim that truth is generally the best vindication against slander, because Trump congenitally slanders and lies. Perhaps every American should read again the Declaration of Independence and note in particular the indictments made against the English king and ascertain how many aptly apply to the current wannabe king emperor who is usurping today's celebration of independence. And perhaps also consider that it was not simply incidental that our revolutionary ancestors chose the month of Julius Caesar to rebel against a monarch. I will be very disappointed if Trump is not struck by lightning at the sculptural feet of the martyred great emancipator for crucifying democracy on Yankee Doodle's birthday. And now, again, something I wrote, which is sort of a pastiche of other things I have written and cobbled together for this particular program, and I call it Democracy's Day. Democracy begins at home, first in the heart. From there, it radiates through the house into the neighborhood and community. It is found in smaller places rather than in centralized illusions of popular culture that reflect mind manipulation and mendacity, as well as gross distortions of constitutional processes and interpretations. Democracy is, after all, a compromise between the yearning for freedom and the urge to frustrate it. It is an elaborate, though inherently fragile, system of concessions between diverse and disparate ambitions and ideologies represented by a variety of economic and political classes, despite an enshrined myth that a democracy is a classless society. The only possible survival for democracy is to establish and sustain balance between conflicting factions so that none gain such power as to be capable of suppressing or ravaging the rest. In that sense, no debate or problem can be fully or finally resolved without its resolution becoming intrinsically repressive. If any one faction tips the balance of power for very long, the fabric of democracy is destroyed. Diversity is democracy, and vice versa. Unfortunately, the country is rapidly retrogressing from a diversely construed democracy centered on the rule of common folk to an aristo-plutocracy of immensely wealthy persons and corporations. The USA is at a crossroads as severe as the Civil War, a crisis that will determine its future as a nation and society, either as a corporate oligarchy administered by questionably elected figureheads or an open society as envisioned in its most fundamental beliefs and laws, as well as a leading member of a world confederacy of presumably eventual democracies. American history boiled to the bone might be encapsulated as war and money rather than about liberty and equality. if it is argued that the wars have all been fought for money. The pursuit of wealth reconfigures as the essential matrix of the USA's manifest destiny. This perspective of history is obviously an injustice to those who have struggled and often been jailed, bled, or died for the larger beliefs relevant in the Bill of Rights, the Ten Commandments of American democracy. Yet the very fact of the intensity of the strife for equity and justice within our own Constitution gives legitimacy to the claim that for the powerful elite, wealth and who gets it is the mainspring of a nation's history. If indeed this narrow view of history has any credence, it must be realized that a select few have from the beginning profited from the collective effort of multitudes of ordinary citizens who generally prefer equity to imbalance. In this context, the term freedom is misapplied, both politically and economically. Free enterprise is a misnomer for the fact that throughout the country's 243-year history, presuming the July 4th, 1776 Declaration of Independence is construed as the nation's true beginning, the wealthiest Americans have for the most part accumulated and maintained their wealth at public expense, essentially through sales and subsidies, which can also be defined as the blood and taxes of the majority, who generally make possible but seldom share in the abundance. The real issue that is ripping apart the fabric of American democracy is the disparity of wealth, which complicates and corrupts every other issue. A few white men of wealth have made an intolerable grab for power and ordination of a country club apartheid that has severely eroded the basic fiber of democracy. They have looted the public treasury of trillions while increasing poverty, joblessness, as well as legal and political savagery, and their short-sighted avarice has burdened generations with a crippling debt that will further limit options and freedoms for millions of yet unborn citizens. Politicians who are supposed to represent the people are just political real estate for rent or lease. The plutocrats, whose affluence is to a major degree based on the upward flow of money provided by the poor and middle class they incessantly impoverish, divert the nation's wealth to their own private and corporate profit. They are the source of the dissolution of the society that indulges their insatiable and arrogant avarice. Capitalism and democracy are not synonymous. During the half-century Cold War with Communist Russia, capitalism was espoused as indistinguishable from democracy. But since the collapse of communism, the ancient antipathy between power at the top and the struggle for freedom at the bottom has accelerated in the United States. The top capitalists do not believe in democracy. They believe in predatory capitalism and in their own sovereign right for power over the rest of the people. Coupled with conspicuous avarice and class discrimination, this is a recipe for the disenfranchisement of ordinary Americans whose lives clearly deteriorate as a result of reactionary economic policies, jobs lost and or sent overseas, labor unions eliminated, workers' rights and wages reduced, hours of work increased without compensation, health plans diminished or abolished, and retirement benefits dissolved. Yet, people still seem indoctrinated by right-wing platitudes that socialist-style government is the problem. The current political climate in the United States is one of incendiary revision, reflected by political parties and politicians condescending to right-wing ideologues and capitalist zealots who manipulate the democratic process to ultimately eradicate it by excluding anything that is different or opposes a grim and vengeful vision of apocalyptic governance that excludes diversity, intelligence, and imagination, and which blames the nation's problems on such interesting and rather progressive persons as feminists, gays and lesbians, blacks, Hispanics, and recently arrived world immigrants who hope for the future rather than cling to noxious images of the past. It is the wealthy whose affluence is to a large degree established on public money paid by the less affluent they incessantly impoverish, who are the real revolutionaries of contemporary America, because they are the source of the dissolution of the essentially liberal society that indulges their insatiable and arrogant avarices. From the very beginning of our democracy, a powerful minority has insisted that liberty is the property of the wealthy elite, and the rest of the population is to be made to serve its interests. They subscribe to a constrained interpretation of the Constitution. Its rights and privileges belong to the wealthy and propertied, its dues and obligations to everyone else. They would like to suspend the Bill of Rights and believe that what they call the original intent of the framers of the Constitution, who were all white propertied and or mercantile males, should be its only interpretation. The rigid concept of original intent is essentially religious in its implication that all progress of intellect, thought, and purpose ended with the instance of the Constitution's origin. It is an absurd and dangerous notion, contrary to the actual intent of the Constitution's authors, to make it flexible enough to reflect future problems and ideas they knew they were unable to anticipate or too contemporarily divided in opinion to immediately resolve, among them the large movements to emancipate slaves and women. Our ancestors who wrote and ratified the Constitution knew very well that governments swallow the rights of their citizens and that the natural inclination of authority is to concentrate and perpetuate its power by any means. Reflexively, government subverts the rights of all but its ruling classes, even if the system originated to provide rights to the governed. The laws of the Constitution, and especially the added-on Bill of Rights, simply make it more difficult for the leaders of government to make the rest of us so completely their subjects. Our Constitution contains much of what is needed to repair the crushing inequality that impairs our society, but it tends to be used to protect privilege and power. Yet historians disagree that the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence are complementary. Their unlikeness is unmistakable, historian Vernon Parrington wrote. The one a classical statement of humanitarian democracy and the Constitution, an organic law designed to protect the minority under Republican rule. The USA is a Yankee Doodle come lately, yet stridently boasts that it is the primal democracy that everyone else should emulate, the exceptionalist nation. In truth, we the people are a beleaguered democracy ripe for judicious reform or replacement by ethical structures of greater personal freedoms that are simultaneously more civically, politically, and economically equitable, a delicate balance always fragile and subject to deformity. Stripped of its fictions and fanfare, all democracy really does is give ordinary people a few tools to use against perfidious misuse of public office by special interests. And if they are not used, we lose the rights and liberties we do possess. Removal of corrupt, negligent, or stupid officials through the vote or recall are among those tools. It might be said that actual unpatriotic, even treasonous behavior is to remain quiet and submissive to policies and abuses of authority that catastrophically imperil or undermine the basic principles of imperfect constitutional democracy. And it might also be construed as treasonous behavior if elected officials, from the president to the most local council person, consistently deceive and arrogantly disregard the majority of the American people. The essential issue is whether we are going to uphold what our ancestors started. The most persistent question is the accommodation of liberty to justice, which has vexed American civilization since its beginning, or if we are going to undo nearly 2.5 centuries of hard-won and often bloody struggles for liberty and justice, and give it all away to a powerful clique of faux aristocrats who manipulate our history as well as our passions and fears. Recurrent political crises quite often reveal a real public impotence of average citizens who would seem to have very little opportunity for input. Most Americans are at the bottom of multifold crises over which they have no control, but affect them most of all. Only through groups, associations, and political parties is there any sense of personal influence. Yet with each successive level, even these are persistently diluted and essentially marginalized to near evaporation. A level to reflect the personal voice must be closer to home, a community voice. Common ordinary citizens who live in neighborhoods and communities, who are ultimately responsible to prevent the sky from falling down around us, because without community, individual voices are lost, diluted, neglected, certainly diffused. Cities and communities are not simply parochial entities concerned only with schools, sewers, streets, and vanishing strip malls. They are primarily integral parts of a political whole and personify the American people at home and work. It is essential that the common consensus adhere to parsimony, patiently trace the confused, corrupt tentacles to their origins, and from that basic point, realize how we got off the track of the history we intended to navigate when our ancestors declared they could no longer abide the oppression of a king. The oligarchic, corporate, and financial aristocracy has eroded the average American's faith in constitutional government so that none would look to it to bring us out of peasantry. These so-called strict constructionists venture to convince the majority of the citizenry that democratic government is the unconstitutional enemy of this people. So whose democracy is it? The original intent of our founding ancestors seems to have been to liberally accommodate extremes of wealth and poverty with the premise of political equality and social mobility available to all Americans. In other words, the only way to preserve democracy is with more democracy, and by keeping a balance between conflicting factions to allow none of them to attain such power as to be capable of suppressing or persecuting the rest. If we wish to take hope and some encouragement in the long struggle to equalize the balance of power in the USA, perhaps it is not too late to agree with James Boyle, who wrote in the New York Times, "One reason we have a democracy in this country is because people make unspeakably stupid decisions without it." Democracy begins at home. And now, Smiling Man. The man was smiling. It was the 4th of July. Somewhere else, small children were parading in patriotic costumes under American flags. The man's face was proud and his smile was gentle. "Look, he must be Thomas Jefferson." People pointed at a small boy with a powdered wig askew who laughed shyly at their attention. "And that must be George Washington. That little girl just has to be Betsy Ross." Perhaps his smile was sad. The crowd laughed at another boy who was Abraham Lincoln trying to keep his whiskers from falling. Mothers and fathers affectionately waved to their children parading by. His friends were not smiling. Great brass bands followed the marching children, crescendoing the air with stirring American songs, the sun shining molten gold on trumpets and bassoons. The smiling man and his friends did not move. Behind the bands came the veterans marching to the drums, wearing blue American Legion or VFW caps, some of them with empty sleeves pinned to their shoulders, others stumped by on artificial legs. There were four of them, counting the smiling man, and they lay on the wet ground of a coconut grove. In the afternoon, after the picnic lunch, some of the men and boys played baseball on the local park diamond while politicians swore their undying patriotism to the crowd sitting on the grass. They threw out such catchwords as liberty and freedom for all as if they were baseballs. Above his sad smile and wide-open eyes, the smiling man's head was neatly cut away, the round lower half almost resembling a child's cereal bowl. His friends laying on the moldy ground had parts of their bodies missing also. A veteran without an arm, who did not wear an American Legion or VFW cap, attempted to shout down the politicians, calling them liars and murderers. He remembered the smiling man and his friends, would in fact never forget them, although in the course of almost a year at war he had seen thousands of dead, most of them farmers and their families, whose bodies were strewn like rubbish around their burned homes or out in their rice fields. The loss of his arm seemed almost a justifiable penance, but he was more often bittered about it. He remembered walking over to the bodies in the coconut grove. He had killed them the night before. He had seen them by the light of a flare trying to set up a machine gun and blew them apart with a hand grenade. It had rained the rest of the night, and in the morning, the bodies lay leached of blood. The smiling man stared at him with dead eyes. He was transfixed by the smile, the neatly cut-away head resembling one of those cornflakes bowls with the comic face his mother had given him when he was a boy. A friend shook him out of it, and he walked away into the months ahead until the war took his arm. Police took his arm and led him away, warning him to not disturb the festivities again or they would lock him up. The smiling man and his friends were left to rot in the grove. The sun set behind tall mountains, and night crept over the bodies. Somewhere else, great colored starbursts flared in the sky, showering the thrilled crowds with streamers of flaming oranges, reds, and yellows. One magnificent burst formed the stars and stripes for a few seconds, and everyone applauded. Elsewhere, also on this night, heavy jet bombers shot into a tropical sky and turned toward a jungled coconut grove. Elsewhere, also on this night, jet bombers shot into a desert sky and turned toward a missile silo. Elsewhere, also on this night, jet bombers shot into an eastern Mediterranean sky and turned toward Serbia. Elsewhere on this night, a missile-armed drone flew down through an Iranian sky. And that was Smiling Man, something I wrote and have read on this program on this occasion before. And this is Michael McCusker. 33 years after the American Revolutionary Congress voted to secede from England on July 2, 1776, a day James Madison said would live in the hearts of Americans forever, the great Shawnee Chief Tecumseh, on the same date in 1809, called on all native peoples to unite and resist white American encroachment on their tribal lands. Tomorrow, July 5th, is the 85th anniversary of Bloody Thursday, which was the most violent day of the Great West Coast Maritime Strike of 1934. Two strikers were shot dead by police and hundreds wounded by gunfire, including women, men, and children not involved in the strike. Although every West Coast port, including Astoria, closed down in support, the strike was centered in San Francisco, where Bloody Thursday occurred. And today, in 1807, the great liberator of Italy, Giuseppe Garibaldi, was born, and for whom Garibaldi, Oregon, is named. Happy Boom Boom Day.